right, let's prepare ourselves for the study of prayer. Now, you should be getting two sheets. Mike will be handing them out. And one will be, as I said, the city layout of Masada. And the other one will just be, you probably won't be able to make it out, but I'll explain it to you as we go along tonight. All right, let's hold everything for a moment and pray. Father, we do thank you for the opportunity to continue our study of this great city of Jerusalem and understand its history, understand its greatness, and understand its fall. To this end, Father, we do pray in Christ's name. Amen. All right, last week we took up the Roman numeral 30. We went ahead and called it that, the completion of the fifth cycle of discipline. And we have several points dealing with that. One, again, dealing with the condition of the nation of Israel. A, B, the fall of Herodium. Remember, we have three cities that are centers for the rebels, the Jewish rebels, to run to and hide. One was called Herodium. B took care of the fall of that, which was really no problem at all. The point C, the fall of Machaerus, and we studied that fall. And then we went to, we're now ready tonight for Roman numeral 31, the siege of Masada. The siege of Masada. Now, Masada is, you will recall, here is the Mediterranean coastline, the Jordan Valley, and we'll say here is the Dead Sea, there's Jerusalem, there's Masada. Herodian is in between, Cyrus on this side of the Dead Sea. So we are now moving to the famous battle area of Masada. With the fall of Masada, we'll have the end of the fifth cycle of discipline administered. They're under the fifth cycle of discipline now. This will be it administered. All right, let's get to work. The siege of Masada. I would definitely like to complete this tonight, and in that way, next week we'll move into church history and go through what's happening as far as Jerusalem is concerned. Those of you that were here Wednesday night, the way that we broke up in 500-year segments, church history, everything relates to Jerusalem in that breakdown. Okay, point one. We're in the siege of Masada, point one. Let's just very quickly, the name Masada comes from a Hebrew word Masuda. But let's see if I can get that on the board. I don't want to take too much time for this. But this is what the word comes from. And looks like this. And that the way it's broken down as far as the vocalization, M-E-S-T, that's the first part. And then the second part, actually, I guess to put the U there, the vocalization. This is the U, and then this is D-A-H, Mahuda. Now, the Hebrew word came into the Greek to be Masada. That was just too much for the Greek, Masuda. And it came into the Greek to drop the T sound, and you just have Masada. And Masada, the word itself means in the Hebrew, the word means stronghold or fortress. Stronghold or fortress, which is a perfect descriptive name for the city of Masada. All right, point two. Masada was an ancient mountaintop fortress. Masada was an ancient mountaintop fortress, naturally built. It's a natural fortress, naturally built on top of a mountain, top of a mountain in southeast Israel. Top of a mountain in southeast Israel. The fortress occupies the entire top of a mountain, the entire top of a mountain, across from the Dead Sea, across from the Dead Sea, on Israel's side of the sea. No one is really certain, and this comes out of Cambridge Ancient History. I decided to go there, couldn't find any other information in biblical references. No one is certain when the area was first inhabited. But it was Herod the Great who will actually build it into a fortress in 30 B.C. And in our notes of the Herodian Empire, we studied Herod building the fortress. in 30 B.C. In this area also, Herod erected, in the area of Masada, Herod erected temples, fortresses, and buildings. He built a magnificent palace known as Herod's Palace. Built a beautiful palace known as Herod's Palace. The water supply was just absolutely ingenious. The aqueduct system that Herod had put into Masada was unbelievable. In order, the water supply would sustain the city for a long surge, a long battle. So it would take care of a long battle. Now, to orient you to history, Herod built the magnificent fortress as a place of refuge for two reasons. The first, not so important. If the Jews were to ever revolt against him, remember, we think of him as a Jew, but remember, he's an Edomian, and he's not a Jew. And he comes in and has gained this great political power in the Jews, but he is not a Jew. So, you know, he's the kind of man that always covers his backyard, and it may be he has to get out of town fast sometimes. So he decided to build Masada for that purpose. Now, that was the first reason that he built it. Now, the second reason is more important. He had a great fear that Mark Antony would eventually give in to the request of Cleopatra. The main reason he built this was that he feared that Mark Antony would give in to the request of Cleopatra, that he, Mark Antony, turn over to her the kingdom of Judea. Cleopatra made it an unnatural geographical observation of why Antony should turn it over to her. And so Herod built the Masada fortress in case that ever happened. Now, it never did. This is one area where Mark Antony did not listen to Cleopatra, but Herod was making himself prepared just in case that ever happened. So he wasn't too confident that it would not ever happen, so he built the fortress. All right, you understand the location of Masada, the strategicness of it. In fact, last week you have a map of how it looks in the area, the mountain ridge, the way it comes up. It's just almost like a cone, a large cone. It just comes up, and there it is. And right up here is Masada. It just as a natural type of fortress. Mike, are you through? Okay, bring me the big book, because I'll need that tonight, please. All right, now, point three. After the death of Herod, Romans occupied Masada. After the death of Herod, Romans occupied Masada with a small force. In the A.D. 66 rebellion, in the 66 rebellion that we have well studied and documented, thank you very much, the Jews led, under as a group of zealots, the rebels, actually captured the fortress. They took control of it in 66 rebellion from the Romans and occupied the fortress until A.D. 73. They will occupy the fortress until A.D. 73. Which will be, of course, the year of the fall of Masada. It will take the Romans 2 years to finally gain control of the fortress. We'll call it a fortress. It will take the Romans really 2 year siege to gain control of Masada and therefore put an end to the Jewish Revolution. This will actually be the end of the Jewish Revolution. This cycle of discipline is still going on, but the end of the revolution itself is dated with the fall of Masada, A.D. 73. Masada is the last holdout for the Jewish rebels. Masada will be the last holdout of the Jewish rebels. Now, point four. The Jewish leader is a rebel named Eliezer. Eliezer, very popular name. You recall there was an Eliezer over at the other fortress across the sea. So Eliezer is a very common Jewish name, and he is the leader, so remember that. Just jumping around, because some of you know something about the city anyway, it will be Eliezer who will give a great speech on why they should all commit mass suicide. So he is the great, he is the leader of this fortress. Now, point five. The leader of the Roman forces, the leader of the Roman forces was Flavius, F-L-A-V-I-U-S, Silva, S-I-V-A. I'm having trouble reading. S-I-L-V-A. Doctor, I guess I better put on my glasses. Let me see. All right. Oh, look at that. All right. Flavius Silva was the leader. And let's continue. He will take over. I might even get through 20 minutes early because I do want to finish the entire area of Masada. I've got a lot to cover tonight. Flavius Silva will take over after the death of Bossius. Now, you recall last week I told you that Bossius was the leader. But he is going to die, and Flavius Silva will take over. Silva realized that Masada was the last stronghold of those rebels who opposed the rule of Rome. Silva realized that Masada was the last stronghold of the rebels who opposed the rule of Rome, and therefore set out his army against the fortress. Set out his army against the fortress. All right, we're ready for point six now. Let's take up under point six, the first stage of the Roman attack. The first stage of the Roman attack. Dash, this the building of a siege dike. The building of a siege dike, much like the one that they built at in the taking of Jerusalem. So we have the building of a siege dike. Now, so we'll know what we're doing here, take a look at the paper you were given tonight so that we can see what's all going to happen here. If you look at your map, what I'm getting ready to talk about is that dark line that is around the city. They are around the whole area. In the front, in the middle there, is the rather odd-shaped top of the mountaintop of Masada. Now, down below the ravine area is the building of the dike where the terrain will allow it to be built. Just so you'll also note what I'll be talking about, if you will look in the upper left corner, say about up to 11 o'clock as far as the clock reads, if you look up there at 10 o'clock, you'll see Camp F. All right, come back around over to around 4 o'clock, and you'll see Camp B and Camp A. Those will be significant as to what I'm getting ready to discuss very, very briefly. All right, so you'll see the siege dike and how it's built around the area of Masada. Just also, if you look at 3 o'clock inside the on top of the mountaintop, you will see Central Palace. Right in the center there on the west side, you will see Central Palace. Now, remember that because that's where all the action is going to take place. That will also be the area where they will commit suicide, and a lot of things will happen there. All right, let's get to work now on the Roman strategy. We're under Major Point 6, where the first stage of attack, the establishment of the siege dike. You know, this is going to be one of the most interesting studies. There's not all that much, but it is an unbelievable accomplishment. Can you imagine the task of even pursuing such a fortress? It just, you know, from the standpoint of looking at it, a rather person that gives up easily would say, well, forget that. But the Romans do not give up easy. Subpoint one. The first thing that Silva did was to erect a siege dike. The first thing Silva did was to erect a siege dike. This is very common Roman strategy. He erected a siege dike as much around the fortress as permitted by the terrain. He built a siege dike around the fortress as much as the terrain would permit. Like the siege dike of Jerusalem, like the siege dike at Jerusalem, its purpose was to establish control of the area. Like the siege dike of Jerusalem, the purpose of this was to establish control of the area and prevent anyone from getting in or out of the fortress. Any help getting in, anyone getting out to try to escape or get some supplies or whatever. So if the purpose of the dike was to gain control and stop any entrance to the city or anyone leaving the city. He then posted sentries. He then posted sentries and garrisons around the dike. You'll note various campsites that are listed on your map around Camp A, Camp H, all of these little areas that were around with little boxes representing the sentry posts. The siege dike was also fortified with catapults, machinery, war machinery, all of which completely isolated the defenders. All of this completely isolated the defenders. So we have very similar to Jerusalem what's going on. Now, add this. One important difference between Jerusalem and Masada. One important difference between Jerusalem and Masada was that on the inside of the walls of Jerusalem, famine spread. In Masada, there is plenty of food and plenty of water. Plus the fact there is only a small force that has to be fed and given water. So there's only a small force to feed, while inside Jerusalem, you recall, there were thousands and hundreds of thousands. So Masada is much different in those respects. Okay, that's point one. Point one, we're under major point six, the first attack. The first thing he did was the siege dike and its and with the garrison troops. Now, secondly, he then established two headquarters. Just summarizing all of these things. He then established two headquarters. One on the eastern side, designated in your map as Camp B. One on the eastern side, designated on your map as Camp B. If you look on your map, you will see a large Camp B right down there around 4 o'clock, Camp B. That will be the headquarters on the east side. Then the main headquarters is designated on your map as Camp F on the northwest side. That's the main headquarters. If you look up around 10 o'clock on your map there, you'll see Camp F, and that is the main headquarters. Now, the main headquarters is on a mountain ridge, and it's very nicely suited, best suited, to direct the entire campaign. You don't get a total view there, but you get your best view of everything going on from that area. The other campsites that are on your map there, the other campsites are the various garrisons and campsites of the Roman forces. So this gives you the layout and how he is getting the attack prepared. Now, point three, sub-point three. The Romans maintained a force of some 15,000. It's always interesting to know the force power of your enemy and the war that you're studying, battle you're studying. The Romans maintained a force of some 15,000 while there were under 1,000 in Masada. And that includes women and children. So we have really a very small fortress of actually fighting men inside the walls of Masada. So again, you're fighting the wall and the fortress more than the men, the soldiers. All right, four. Simply stated, the chief military problem to the Romans was, quote, how to get their siege towers up to the walls of the fortress at the top of the cliff. That's putting it as simply as possible. How to get their siege towers up to the walls of the fortress at the top of the cliff. Now we're ready for major point seven. Major point seven, second stage of attack. Second stage of attack. These glasses are horrible because I refuse bifocals, and these are designed for right here, and I look up and I can't see you. So I am getting old and falling apart. All right, second stage of attack, getting to Masada. Second stage of attack, getting to Masada. One. All right, now just, you know, putting it in simple forms, there's our layout. Here is Masada on top of the ridge, ravines all around, and you've got to get up there. All right, one. There was only one area that could possibly support the siege fortress. Only one area that could possibly support the siege fortress. That is, for the port, the required earthworks and machinery, war machinery, necessary to scale the walls atop the mountain and batter the walls. In other words, make a breach. There's only one area that could possibly support all of this. This was a small area on the west side of Masada. This is a small area on the west side of Masada supporting the road which led up to the central palace. It supports the road that leads up to the central palace on the west side. The area was wide enough for the operation of the earthworks. Point two. This area was called White Cliff. Now, if you'll look, I didn't get me a copy of it, but you have a handout tonight that has two pictures on it. And the top picture gives you an idea of what the White Cliff looked like. So that's what that is. I'm sorry, it's not a good copy, but it's a black and white in the book itself, and that's what the White Cliff looks like. That is just that you can see the two ravines on each side coming up like this. And this area in between here, as you see the whiteness of it, it's called White Cliff. Still there today. All of this is really fascinating, the books say, as far as visiting today. And even a lot of the work we're getting ready to see that the Romans did is still there today. It is the one best area for Roman war and their building than they have anywhere left in the Roman Empire. It's right here at Masada. This is an unbelievable example of what they did. All right, now point two, under major point seven, sub point two, the area is called White Cliff. It was a low area. It was a low area between two ravines. There was still a distance of some 260 feet. Now, I always like to put things in reference to a football field. I feel like most people can comprehend distance from a football field standpoint, since it's so common to us. That would be approximately 86 yards. So if you look at it from your own yard line, you're on the enemy's 86-yard line. See? You have 14 yards for a touchdown. And that gives you an idea of how far it is from the where the ravine that you have, the White Cliff, up to the top where those walls are. So you have 86 yards, that far to go, and very, very steep. The Romans were able to take possession of White Cliff. The Romans were able to take possession of White Cliff without much difficulty. And now began the task of scaling that 260 feet to the top of Masada. Now that's the next task, to do that. Now, point three. The Roman commander, Silva, ordered the building of an embankment. They ordered the building of an embankment. Now, point four. First they built... The first embankment they built the first thing they built to build a solid ramp or a platform. And this is what's partly still there today. Build a ramp or a platform. This ramp was built as an assault embankment. And this still exists today. So what they did, they built an embankment. And in the book that I have here they have masterfully put together Josephus's work, and they've got all the engineers, and they show how all of these things are done mathematically. But what they did, they built embankments made out of stone, something like this. Built embankments up to the top here. And as I said, it still exists today as a remarkable structure of Roman siege tactics. And on top of the platform then, on top of the platform was placed a siege tower, much like the towers that we studied in the taking of Jerusalem. They really went to a lot of work to win battles. When they reached this point, let's just say, for the sake of our drawing,
Here is the top level. Then what they did, they built a siege tower. See? So we're going to put a tower.
But before I do, let me tell you, the top of this tower, the top of the tower, actually will stand some 20 feet above the walls of Masada,
which it has to. See? So you build your tower now, and here's our tower, some 20 feet above the walls of Masada. Now, if you're thinking militarily, this is an obvious thing. Here would be the tower. Let's take a side view coming down on our platform. And here would be the walls of Masada. See, now what you do from up here is now you can shoot down, see, with your machinery, your light artillery that you're able to get up on top of the tower. You shoot down with your light artillery. That keeps the fortresses on the wall from shooting down while you bring up your big machinery and start to this level and start battering the walls of Masada.
So that's what the Romans are going to accomplish in all of this. So, point four, on top of the platform was placed a siege tower. The top of the tower actually stood some 20 feet above the walls of Masada. The tower was overlaid with iron plates to prevent the tower from being burned. See, the tower is made out of wooden beams. All you'd have to do is set the beams on fire and you destroyed the tower. Work. But what they did, they overlaid the tower with these plates of iron. Now, if you look on that map, on that picture I gave you, the bottom picture, on that picture, the black and white, now that's a war machinery. That's a battering ram, but that's a picture of the type of plates, the iron plates that they put not only on their machinery, but on this tower. So if you have that, you can see how all of that was done right there on the battlefield. So that's what they did, and that way the Jews would not be able to burn the work. Now, from the tower, continuing now, from the tower, the Romans could keep the defenders pinned down. So they could not open fire on the Roman forces who were bringing up the battering ram, and then, of course, attacking the walls. Point five. On the 1st of May, 73 A.D., the walls of Masada were breached. Point six. The defenders of Masada, however, realized what was happening and used the time, Eleazar, to actually construct an inner wall, a second wall inside the first wall, inside of the fortress, inside of the first wall. Now, this wall, the second wall, was more pliant. That is, it's made of material that is more flexible, and the battering ram does not destroy it, see? They build a more pliant wall that would not be destroyed by the battering rams. So the wall would stand there. It was standing the battering from the Romans' war machines. Now, I started to, going to read this very slowly, but not too far along. I'll be having all of this printed up for you. I want to read to you the description of this wall. And the reason I decided to do this was just for those of you that can comprehend these things, the amount of work that all these people go through to defend the city and all the things done right out on the field. Still one of the most interesting things, one of many, in touring of the Civil War battlefields, I would get in trouble by a true Southerner. This is really the second war for independence, the first against Britain and the second against the Northerners. But for the sake of discussion, the Civil War, was the amount of digging and earthwork and all this that went on. Jim Passmore and I were just constantly laughing and amused. And most of them, they never really fought. They just learned to dig. And you move into an area and you got to dig, and you build embankments and all of these types of things. But that's the way it was throughout history. Let me give you a description of this second wall so you can appreciate the genius in defending the city as well as the genius of the Romans. They would use huge beams, were laid lengthwise and fastened together at their ends. These were in two parallel rows. You may not grasp all this, but you'll get a general idea. These were in two parallel rows, a wall's breadth apart, with the space between them filled with earth. So they built them, and then they put earth in between. And in order to prevent the earth from falling out as the mound rose, they laid beams transversely to fix firmly those that laid the long way. The construction presented to the enemy the appearance of normal masonry. I'm just quoting right out of Josephus. But the blows of the battering rams on yielding earth were weakened, while the concussion actually settled the earth together and helped to solidify it. That is the second wall. So they really came up with an ingenious way to stop the structure. Only one little silly problem. Very simple little problem with all of this. Anybody know? Huh? Digging? No, it's easier than that. They're wood. You can burn them. So, point seven. And it's a great idea, but they should have learned from the Romans, put the metal plates over them. That's what they should have done, but look what happened. Therefore, of course, that would have taken away that pliant principle. So, you can't win. All right, point seven. Therefore, the next obstacle for the Romans was the second wall. See, I think it's ingenious the Romans got this far. But now they have a lesser problem, the second wall. Sylva realized that his battering rams were not too effective against the wall. He began to realize, well, something's not right. These walls aren't giving. He didn't know why, but he knew they weren't giving. He quickly noted that they were made of wood and therefore would burn. Made of wood, it'll burn. He ordered a constant volley of burning torches at the wall. The wood soon caught on fire. But listen to this. This is fun things that happen, and we think Hollywood's the only one that can think of these things. The wood soon caught on fire, but just as the fire really got started, a strong wind broke out, causing the flames to actually blow and burn toward the Romans, causing the Romans to retreat. But almost as suddenly, the wind shifted, blowing back toward the wooden earthworks, and soon it was, quote, a blazing mass from top to bottom. So it's one of those little things that happened to encourage the Jews, discourage the Romans, and then all of a sudden take it away from you again. All right, that's what I like the Cowboys. They let the other team ahead until the last minute and then take it away from them. All right, so point eight. By this time, night had fallen. By this time, night had fallen, and the Romans returned to their camp to prepare for the final attack the following day, leaving night sentries to guard the work accomplished. Brings us to major point eight, the night of mass suicide. The night of mass suicide, or the last night of the administration of the fifth cycle of discipline. I say administration because they're still under it. But the administration, this will be the actual last night of administration. Okay, point one, subpoint one. The Jewish leader, Eliezer, inside of Masada, realized the end was near. The Romans had actually accomplished the impossible. They had scaled the high mountains of Masada, and on the next day would control the city. The next day they would control the city. He also knew the fate of every man, woman, and child once they would be captured by the Romans. He knew the fate of every man, woman, and child once they would be captured by the Romans. And it was his opinion that death was preferable. So it was his opinion that the suicide would be preferable to what the Romans would do to them. All right, two. Therefore, that night, Eliezer gathered all the people together and gave his appeal for mass suicide. I'm always interested in speeches, as you know by now. The speeches of history intrigue me. And a speech to cause people to commit suicide has got to be rather intriguing. I mean, you better be a doggone good salesman to get people to take their own life. I hope you'll be interested. I want to read to you Eliezer's first address, convincing the people to commit suicide. Eliezer, because this is obviously the most famous thing dealing with Masada, is the suicide of the Jews. Eliezer, however, intended neither to slip out nor to allow anyone else to do so. Seeing the wall going up in flames and being unable to devise any further means of escape or heroic resistance, he foresaw clearly what Romans would do to the men, women, and children if they had won, and he thought that death was preferable to all. Deciding that this was the best course under the circumstances, he assembled the toughest companions and urged it upon them the following address. Quote, "Long since my brave companions..." By the way, something kept running to my mind all the way through this. I want you to concentrate on the speech, so let me tell you what happened. Everyone's going to be killed that night through suicide and killing of wife, and they kill your own wife, kill your own children. It all goes down to who's going to kill who. I always laugh because the last man could have walked out. But anyway, he will be dumb and go ahead and kill himself. And but two smart women, one very old woman who decided she hadn't lived long enough yet, and a very young woman who was very smart, decided this is really stupid. So they took five children and hid in all the confusion. And they're the ones who gives us the ideal of the speech. Okay. "Long since, my brave companions, we determined to serve neither Romans nor anyone else, but only God. For he alone is the true and righteous Lord of men. Now the time has come that bids us prove our resolution by our deeds. At this crisis, we must not disgrace ourselves. But till now, we have never submitted to slavery, even if it involves no danger. In choosing slavery, now we would deliberately accept the horrible penalties that await us if we fall alive into Roman hands. For as we were the first of all to revolt, we are the last to fight against them. Moreover, I think it is God who has granted us this privilege." Note what happens in arrogance of the fifth cycle of discipline. "That it is our power to die bravely in freedom." Well, that, you know, the Jews said to Christ, "We're not enslaved, we're free." They were enslaved to sin, they were enslaved to the Mosaic Law, and they were enslaved to the Roman Empire. They were already under three shackles. But in their arrogance, they told Christ, "We are free." So that he does the same thing. When you are in blind arrogance and have a blackout of the soul, you have no sensitivity to your circumstances. All right? "Unlike others who were unexpectedly defeated, it is evident that tomorrow we will be captured, but we are free to choose an honorable death together with those we love most. Our enemies cannot prevent this, though they fervently pray to take us alive. Nor can we defeat them in battle. Perhaps from the very first, when we were bent on freedom, but suffered such hard treatment from one another, and worse, from our enemy, we ought to have read God's purpose and realized that his once beloved Jewish race had been doomed to extinction." False. "For if he had remained gracious, or only slightly indignant with us, he would not have shut his eyes to such wholesale destruction, or have abandoned his holy city to be burnt to the ground by our enemies. And did we really hope that all of the Jewish race, we alone, would come through safe, still in possession of our freedom, as if we were guiltless before God and had taken no part in crime? We who have been the teachers of all the others..." See, he still thinks the problem is what they've done to each other, not to Christ. "Now, see how he shows us the folly of our hopes, plunging us into more dire distress than we could have anticipated. For not even the impregnability of this fortress has sufficed to save us. Though we have food storages in abundance, piles of arms, more than enough of every other necessity, yet manifestly God himself has deprived us of all hope of deliverance. For the flames that were carried back into the enemy lines did not turn back at their own accord toward the wall we constructed. No, all these things signify God's vengeance for the many wrongs that we dare to inflict on our countrymen in our madness. No, for the rejection of the Messiah. For these crimes, let us pay the penalty, not to our bitterest foes, the Romans, but to God, by our own hands. It will be easier to bear his judgment than theirs. Let our wives die undishonored, and our children without knowing slavery. When they are gone, let us do each other an unbegrudging kindness, preserving our liberty as a noble funeral monument. But first let us destroy our belongings in the fortress by fire, for the Romans, I know, will be grieved to lose our persons and all their gain at the same time. Let us spare only one thing, our store of food, for it will testify when we are dead that we did not perish through want, but because, in keeping with our initial resolution, we chose death to slavery. Well, you can imagine that such a speech would have a little bit of some nice ideas, but it is totally an asinine speech. We're not going to break it apart, but erroneous from beginning to end, and it has no strength at all. I have here, and we don't have time to read it, but I have here in the book Time to Stand, General Travis's speech to the men at the Alamo. Similar type of circumstances in which they knew they were going to die. And the famous speech by Travis, same type of circumstances. He knows he's going to die. And the great speech of freedom and Texas, and that they wanted to try to escape, let any man escape. There was nothing wrong with that. He was going to stay there and fight. And, of course, all the Texans who stayed and died there. And we have so many areas in history where men knew that they were going to die, and none did such an asinine thing as to have mass suicide. That solves nothing at all. But the speech by Travis is very short, very direct, as far as what war and death is all about. So we're not impressed with the mass suicide of the Jews, but it is indicative to you and me what happens when we're under the fifth cycle of discipline. Now, point three, though. Point two was the speech. Point three, some of the Jews felt greatly relieved by this solution. Some of the Jews felt greatly relieved by the solution and were actually happy over the thought of dying in such a way. However, there were others that didn't think it was such a good idea. And there were quite a few that looked around at their families and it just didn't appeal to them right at the moment that that was a very good idea. So they did not want to die or to have their families die in this manner. Point four, at this point, Eliezer gave his second great speech, exhorting the weak to understand what he felt was the better solution of all of this than to give over to the Romans. Now, the second speech covers a tremendous number of areas. It starts off, as far as the second speech, I was greatly mistaken in thinking that I had brave companions in our struggles. The situation, as the lady describes it, was that Eliezer looked out there and he saw that some men supported it, but there were others who didn't support it. And before he let that catch on, people start talking to each other and decide what they're going to do, he immediately jumped up and gave his following second speech. I was greatly mistaken in thinking that I had brave companions in our struggles for freedom. Men resolved to live honorably or die. But I find that you are not in the least different from the common herd in boldness and courage. You who fear death even when it will save you the greatest misery. A cause in which you ought not to hesitate for a moment or wait for someone to advise you. For from old, since the first dawn of intelligence, we have been continually impressed by those ancestral and divine precepts supported by the actions and spirit of our forefathers that life is man's misfortune, not death. For death gives freedom to our souls and lets it depart to its own pure abode where it will not experience any calamity, but while it is confined within a mortal body and is affected by its miseries, In strict truth, it is dead, for association of the divine with the mortal is unbefitting. It is true that the soul wields great power even when imprisoned in the body, for it makes the latter its instrument of sense, moving it invisibly and directly, and directing it onward in its actions further than mortal nature can reach. However, it is not until the soul is free from the weight that drags it down to earth and is hung about it that it is restored to its proper place. Then in truth it partakes of the blessed energy and power unfettered on every side, and it remains invisible to human eyes like God himself. For it is withdrawn from the view even while it is in the body. It enters unperceived and departs unseen. For it is one and incorruptibly by nature, while causing a change in the body. For whatever the soul torches, lives and blossoms, whatever it deserts, withers and dies, so abundant is her immortality. Take sleep. It provides you with the clearest proof of what I say. Gives a dissertation on sleep. Gives some examples of some heathenistic tribes. Then he goes over to God's sentence. Yet even if from the very first we have been taught the opposite doctrine that life is indeed man's greatest blessing and death is a disaster, the situation is such that we call to bear it with a stout heart, since it is God's will and sheer necessity that doom us to death. Long ago it seems God passed this decree regarding the whole Jewish race together that we must depart from this life if we do not use it properly. Do not fasten the blame on yourselves, nor give the Romans credit for the fact that we are ruined as a result of war. For it was not their power that brought all of this to pass, but a more powerful cause has intervened to give them the semblance of victory. And let me ask, what Roman weapons slew the Jews at Caesarea? Why? Then he goes through some of the things that happened to the Jews at Caesarea. Self-delusion of the Jews, arms, walls, impregnable forces, and a spirit unshaken by the dangers they took in the cause of liberty. These encouraged them all to rebel. Yet those availed us, but for a short time they raised our hopes only to prove that on the outset of our mounting disasters, for we were all taken, all succumbed to the enemy, if provided especially to enhance their triumph and not for the deliverance of the lives of those who furnished them. We may well truly congratulate those who perish in the war, for they died defending and not betraying liberty. But who would not pity the masses who are now under the thumb of Rome? Who would not hasten to die rather than share their fate? Some of them have been broken on the rack or tortured to death by fire. Others have been half-eaten by wild beasts, then kept alive to provide them as food for a second time in order to afford merriment and sport to the enemy. And those who are still alive must be reckoned as the most miserable, for they have often prayed for a death that does not come. Where is the mighty city, the mother city, the whole Jewish race, entrenched behind so many lines of ramparts and sheltered behind so many forts and lofty towers that could hardly contain the provisions of war and defend by thousands upon thousands of determined men? What was become of that city that was believed to have God as her founder? Uprooted from her base, she has been wiped out, and all remains of her is the camp of those who destroyed her, occupying her ruins. Wretched old men sit dejected beside the ashes of the sanctuary, and a few women have been reserved by the enemy for the barest outrage. Which of us, realizing all these facts, could bear to face the sun, even if we could not, if we could live from danger? Who can be such an enemy of his own country, so unmanly, so fond of life, as not to be sorry he still lived today? Indeed, if only we had all died before seeing the holy city raised by the enemy's hands and that sacred sanctuary so impiously uprooted. But since an honorable hope deluded us into thinking that we might perhaps succeed in avenging her of her enemies, and now all that hope has vanquished and left us alone in our distress, let us at once choose death bravely. Let us have pity on ourselves and wives and children while we are still able to take pity on ourselves. For we were born to die, and those who have brought us into the world, then this even the most fortunate must face.
but outrage, slavery, and the sight of our wives led away into shame with our children. These are no necessary evils to which man is subject by nature. These befall men who would undergo them by their own cowardice. Those who have the possibility to forestall them by death, but still refuse to take it. But we, who are very proud of our courage, revolted from Rome, and in the final stages they offered to spare our lives, and we turned the offer down. Who can fail to foresee their rage if they take us alive? Miserable will be the young men whose strong bodies can sustain many tortures. Wretched the old men whose frames will not be able to sustain such torture. Is a man to see his wife let off, to be violated, to hear the voice of his child crying, Father? Well, he's quite a speech giver, isn't he? Crying, Father, when his own hands are chained. Come while our hands are free to hold the sword. Let them do a noble service. Let us die before we become slaves under our enemies, and leave this life together as free men with our children and our wives. This is what our tradition ordains. This is what our wives and children implore us to do. God himself has imposed on us the necessity to do so, while the Romans wish to do us the reverse, for they are anxious that none of us should die before the capture. Let us therefore make haste, and before affording them their hoped-for pleasure of seizing us, leave them to be dumbfounded by our death and awed by our fortune. Well, what happened was, the next paragraph goes on to describe how the people went off and started slaughtering. So irresistible a desire has seized them to slaughter their wives and their little ones and themselves. It might have been expected that they approached their task, their determination would have cooled. But they clung to the purpose they had formed while listening to the address. And although personal emotion and love were alive in all of them, reason had urged what was best for their loved ones prevailed. For at the very moment when they embraced and caressed their wives and took their children in their arms, pressing upon them the last kisses, hands seemingly other than their own assisted them in accomplishing their purpose. And the thought of the agonies, this is the fifth cycle of discipline, and the thought of the agonies they would suffer from the enemy consoled them for the necessity of killing each other. And in the end, not a man failed to carry out his terrible deed. One and all disposed of their families, wretched victims of necessity, who with their own hands slew their wives and their children, and felt it to be their lightest of evils. Unable now to endure any longer their horror at what they had done, and thinking they would be wronging the slain by outliving them even a short while, they quickly piled together all those provisions, set them on fire. Then, having chosen 10 men by lot, they found the lots, by the way, to be the executioners of the rest. Each laid himself down beside his wife and children, flinging his arms around them, exposed their throats to those who had to perform the painful office. The latter unflinchingly slaughtered them all, then followed the same mode for each other, so that the one who drew the lot should kill the 9, and then himself last of all. Such mutual confidence they all had in each other, that neither in doing nor in suffering would one differ from another. So finally the 9 bared their throats, and he who was the last of all, after surviving the prostrate multitude, in case, amid all the slaughter, someone was left who needed his hand, and finding that all had been slain, set the palace ablaze, and then, summoning all his strength, drove his sword right through his body and fell dead beside his family. And so is the slaughter of Masada. Let's finish up some notes here, and that will take care of the fall of Masada. Point five, the people at this time were moved by Eliezer's speech and set out to kill each other and their families. Point six. seven people had escaped. Seven people had escaped the self-inflicted massacre. An old woman and a younger woman, well-educated, and five children. Doesn't say how, but this woman is related to Eliezer. These seven, remember he's of an aristocratic family, so this woman's well-educated. These seven made their way to an underground aqueduct during all the confusion, and they hid there. Seven, 960 bodies were found, including women and children. 960 bodies were found, including women and children. Major point nine. The Roman forces enter Masada. Roman forces enter Masada. One. The Romans naturally expected a great battle the next morning. The Romans naturally expected a great battle the next morning, prepared themselves for the final attack. Two. In the morning light of May, they scaled the walls once again, charged through the breach in the second wall. In the morning light, they scaled the walls once again, charged through the breach in the second wall, but once inside, they were shocked to find no resistance at all. Once inside, they were shocked to find no resistance at all. Three, the Romans could not understand some of the dead bodies they found. Bewildered, they gave another war shout, hoping that this would encourage the defenders to open fire. Standing around shouting, "Where are you? Come on out and fight." Four. Finally, only the two women with the children emerged, informed the Romans of what had happened, informed the Romans of what had happened that horrible night. The younger woman gave a detailed report of Eliezer's speech. Five. The Romans found it most difficult to believe, made their way into the palace, and indeed found the suicidal graveyard. They put out their fires, secured what was of value, and departed. They put out the fire, secured what was of value, and departed. Finally, six. And so, with the fall of Masada, 73 A.D., the fifth cycle of discipline had now been administered to the Jews for their rejection of Jesus Christ. Gracious Lord and Heavenly Father, appreciative we are for the opportunity to study this history in Christ's name. Amen.